From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
Well, in my 44 years as an interviewer, I've interviewed Cliff Richard, Hank Marvin, Jet Harris, Licorice Locking, Brian Bennett, Cliff Hall, and long, long last, wonderful Bruce Welch. Good to see you.
Hello there. Hiya, John.
Now, we owe this...
How come it took so long?
I don't know.
You did everyone else except me.
I know. I have tried, but...
You better get me before I pop off.
Oh, there's a lot of life in you. You look terrific.
Thank you.
We met both watching one of our 50s idols, didn't
we? Absolutely.
So we were at the Playdium the other afternoon watching the sound check, my son and I. Mrs. Dwayne Eddy said, come and watch the sound check.
Yeah.
I said to my son, God, there's Bruce Welch over there. And went and asked you for an interview, and that's why you're here.
That's why I'm here.
So it's absolutely brilliant to see you.
Thank you very much.
And
thank
as you. I said on that night, congratulations on the music you and the boys have played over the years, because it's been an inspiration to so many of us, really.
It's only 60 years, John. Only 60 years.
Good for a boy from Bognor, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, local, local.
Yes, just along the
local
south
to
coast.
You.
Yeah, exactly. I know you sort of only lived in Bognor for a while, then went to Chester-le-Street, Street, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, I did, yeah.
That was a culture shock or not, really?
Well, it was the war, of course. I was born in November 41, and Mr. Hitler was just across the water, really, in those days. So I think I was about three, or maybe under a bit less than three, when we went to Chester-le-Street Street, which is where I grew up, actually. I went to school in Chester-le-Street Street from the age of 5 to the age of 11. So I was a Chester-le-Street Street boy the 40s, of course, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Sadly, your mum died when you were quite young.
I was 5, yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah, she died of TB, which now you can cure, but in those days you couldn't, yeah.
How did you cope being so young, really? How did you cope?
I didn't really know her, John, to be honest. I have no recollection of her at all. I've got a couple of photographs at home. Me on her knee when I was about 9 months old, and another one. I was probably about, I don't know, 2, trying to walk around the garden, you know. And that's it. That's it. Gosh, she spent a couple of years in a sanitarium.
Oh.
So I don't have any... tangible memory of her at all, I'm afraid.
I know you had a few uncles, and one called Uncle Norman bought you a ukulele, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. I don't think he was a real... You know, everyone was uncle in those days. You know,
exactly.
Friends of the family were uncle. And, Uncle Norman, when I was 8, turned up with a ukulele. Now, he could play it. I couldn't play it. And anyway, he left it, and that... You know, who knows? I mean, in your subconscious, just holding a little, 8 years old.
Gosh.
I certainly couldn't play it. I couldn't play one now. But who knows? I don't know whether that subconsciously thought, ooh, this, you know, feels all right at the age of 8. I doubt it, but it, still.
It got wet.
It's a memory.
Didn't it get wet?
It got wet and disintegrated.
Oh.
Yeah, as you do.
They tell me you were inspired when you saw a movie when there was a song called There's No Business Like Show Business. Is that a true story?
It is a true story. My auntie, when we were living in Chester-le-Street Street, Aunt Sadie, who brought me up, who was my mum's sister, obviously, she was a market trader. So I think it was every Friday, happened to be the Chester-le-Street Street market. So she used to travel around Newcastle and South Shields and Stockton and all those places. So... I think it was after school I went to see this movie because the movie house was 100 yards from the market. I used to go and see movies because it was like took you to spend time because I didn't want to stand on the market all day with Aunt Sadie. But saw, I'm trying to think of the name of the movie, man. It was Ethel Merman though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And there's that song and I must have been 10 maybe, probably about 10 because I moved to Newcastle when I was 11, so... And there's that fantastic song that with that fantastic lyric. There's no business like show business. You know, there's no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. All that stuff. And I thought, again, in your subconscious, you think, no, I couldn't have. It just seemed appealing somehow.
When you were growing up, it was almost like every boy's dream. You lived over a fish and chip shop for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, well, yeah. We owned it.
Right.
I say we. I didn't own it, but they owned it. And of course, I used to have to do chores in the fish shop after school. So in those days, there was no automation. I used to, in the backyard of the fish shop, outdoors, we used to have a potato peeling machine, cold water and potatoes. And I used to, you know, do that and then literally press it down on the thing and it would turn into chips. And I used to gut the fish. Very exciting when you're a young boy. You know,
let's
chop the heads off and take all the guts out and hand it over. So that was my other career.
When you and I were growing up, the radio was the big thing, of course, wasn't it? The Goon Show, educating Archie and all. You were sort of, like me, I guess, fascinated by those radio shows, weren't you, really?
Well, we all were. I mean, it was like listening to, you know, the Goons and Charles Chilton's Riders of the Range and Dick Barton. Barton was unbelievable, you know, when you were a kid. It's your imagination with radio, isn't it?
Yeah.
But growing up again, what was fantastic for me, and you're probably going to come on to it, was in Newcastle, we had an empire. Most of the big cities, towns had empires, which was variety. So I could go and see, and I did, because maybe that line about there's no business like show business, I could go and see Slim Whitman, Billy Eckstein, Lonnie Donegan, The Platters, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. They all would come and do a week in variety. Somehow, I don't know where the money came from, but somehow I would go and see these shows. And when I was 14, 15, and I thought, you know, you think, this has got to be the life. This has to be the life. It looks so exciting. And I love the music, you know, especially when the Platters and people like that came.
Gosh, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic.
I used to go to Portsmouth to the Theatre Royal there or the Empire there. Mm-hmm. And I saw Frankie Vaughan in his third week in the business.
Uh-huh.
And
nice man.
Lovely man.
Nice man, yeah.
And I saw lots and lots of people that later became stars. And I saw Michael Benteen and people like that.
Yeah.
So good to look back.
We worked the Palladium with him.
Did you?
Yeah. We did 6 months at the Palladium with Michael in 1960.
You like Ray Ellington, didn't you?
Well, he was there.
Yes.
You know, he was radio and what was the harmonica player? Max Geldre.
Max Geldre, yeah.
Max Geldre. There again, that's the radio. You were glued to radio, and especially the Goons.
Yes.
If you were of a certain nature, the Goons were just...
Eccles, wasn't it? And all whatever. Lovely
fantastic
stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Then, of course, Donegan came along as well, which was quite important for lots of young guys, wasn't it, really?
Lonnie in the UK. Mm. I don't know if we're going to talk about it again, but I mean, obviously rock and roll came from America. So first influences were from 1955, I guess. Bill Haley came with Rock Around the Clock. I can remember going to the cinema in Newcastle where all the Teddy Boys were ripping up the seats, you know, because of that song. That music was just so, so exciting. And Elvis came. So January 56, on the BBC, I heard some guy saying, and now we have this very, very plummy, you know, the old accent, very, very British.
Oh, yes.
Very, very posh.
They used to wear dress suits.
Yeah, and the guy would say, and he said, and now we have a record from America, Elvis Presley. And it was Heartbreak Hotel.
Wow.
And we went, whoa, what is that? What is that? And exactly the same time in January 56, in the UK, we had Lonnie Donegan and his Skiffle Group, doing Rock Island Line.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. And Lonnie became the catalyst for so many of people like me and Hank and Brian May and Eric Clapton and Harrison. Lonnie used to say, anybody can do this sort of music. All you need is two or three guitars and a washboard and a T-chess bass and things. And so many of us at school started a skiffle group. John and Paul started one in Liverpool. You may have heard of them. Hank and I had one at school called the Railroaders. So we, at the age of 14 in 1956, we had the Railroaders at school. And but skiffle was a huge, huge thing. And Lonnie was obviously the king. He was the king. So everybody sang Lonnie Donegan songs. We all sang Elvis songs. We sang Bill Haley songs, Razzle Dazzle and all that stuff. See you later, alligator. All that stuff. It was magic. I can't tell you. Well, you're old enough to remember. Almost. Not as old as me, but almost. I can't tell you the excitement that it was to young kids, because this was new music. This was not your parents' music. This was not, with all due respect, this was not the big band music with the big band singers. Dickie Valentine became a friend of mine, and he was huge.
Wonderful singer.
As a crooner.
Yeah.
You know.
Ronnie Hilton, Ronnie Carroll.
Yeah. You know, all of those guys that we worked with when we made it, you know, with the so rock and roll took over in a huge way from that era, if you like.
In a couple of weeks, I'm interviewing someone I've interviewed several times, Charlie Gracie,
yeah,
who had a great influence. He was one of the early rock and rollers.
I saw him, 1957, Newcastle Empire.
Wow.
Yeah.
John Hannam is on the air now. Hannam? Hannam? Doesn't matter. He's a lovely boy.
You actually met this guy called Brian Rankin, didn't you, when you got your 11 plus?
When I was 11, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was
Bruce Cripps.
Yes, you were,
I was born Bruce Cripps.
Yes, yeah.
But my mother's name was Welsh. And I thought, first of all, I was going to be Buddy Cripps or, you know, Elvis Cripps. That didn't sound right. So I kept Bruce and took my Welsh, and Grace Welsh, yeah, yeah.
Because some call you Welsh and some call you Welch, don't they? Well, I've always called you Welch.
Yeah, Dwayne, my son, says Welch.
Right.
Good enough for me then.
I say Welsh, C-H. I always say C-H because most people write S-H. But yes, I met this Brian Rankin when we were 11. Somehow we passed the 11 plus. And I left Chesley Street to move to Newcastle and went to Rutherford School there. So that's where we met. In fact, we met on the very first day. We arrived there, obviously not knowing each other. And over the next sort of 2 or 3 years, you know, when skiffle came especially, we were always interested in music, but when skiffle came, Hank had a skiffle group. He was a very traditionalist. He wore the blue duffel coat, the college scarf, and he played the banjo.
Did he?
He played banjo first. And then I got him to join the Railroaders skiffle group, which was our skiffle group at school. And his father, bless him, bought Hank a guitar for his 16th birthday. And he bought him a little Hofner Congress, which was 16 guineas. And he played that. He switched from banjo to guitar. And he was already quite brilliant as a musician. He was just so inventive at 16, you know, 16 years old. And I was just three chords almost in any key. I didn't know any keys then.
You went off to London to go into a big contest, didn't you, with the Railroaders?
Yeah, we did, yeah, yeah, yeah. We came. Do you want me to ramble on about it?
Yeah, we came down.
I don't know how we found out about it. Anyway, there was some competition in the Granada Edmonton on a Sunday night. This was April of 1958. So the band came down. We all came down. Hank's dad worked on British Rail, so he managed to get us a cheap fares down to London, into King's Cross. Anyway, went to, did the show, and didn't win. We came third, I think. So it's a Sunday night, and the manager of the place was a huge Scots guy, lovely guy. And he said, oh, where are you going, lads? What are you doing now? This is after the show was over. And we said, well, don't know, really. He said, what do you mean we don't know? He said, where are you staying tonight? You know, obviously from Newcastle. I said, well, we don't know. We don't know yet. It's, you know, we don't know anybody. He said, really? I said, yeah, we don't know anything. So he said, hang on a minute. And he went and rang someone, which turned out to be a landlady in Finsbury Park. And he told us when he came back, he said, I rang this lady I know. She's a Geordie. And she let us sleep in her attic. I suppose officially for maybe a couple of nights. But Hank and I stayed there for 6 months. But then on the Monday, the next day, the two other guys said, we're going to go home. In a broad Geordie, we're going here. You know, we're going home. So and Hank and I said, we think we'll stay. We were in London. You know, we were there. It was just, and that was the biggest decision I think we ever made right, to stay.
Yeah, the Two Eyes, obviously.
Yeah. Then we went on to the Two Eyes.
Because you worked there as well, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Why I?
Yeah.
You're going to have to stop me, John, if you want me to stop talking, because I'll ramble on 4 or 5 hours.
I don't mind at all.
No, no. So the next day we had heard about this famous coffee bar called the Two Eyes Coffee Bar in Soho. And it was famous because Tommy Steele had been discovered there. So I think between late 56 and certainly when we got there in April 58, there were so many wannabes, all the wannabe, you know, wannabe discovered, wannabe stars, and all the, everybody went there, you know, and Hank and I turned up. We were the Geordie boys, you know, we thought we were Don and Phil Everly at the time. We were a cross between Don and Phil Everly, Elvis and Buddy Holly and everybody else.
Yes.
You know, as you do. And we managed to be sort of hired, not technically, but they let us play maybe four nights a week, play and sing. Not just us, because it was one of those places where people would say, can I get up and jam with you? Can I do a couple of numbers with you? Can I play drums? Can I do this? And they did. And so Hank and I managed to work there maybe 3 or 4 nights a week. And we got the equivalent of what is now 80p a night. So it was, not a lot. 18 shillings in those days. And on the nights that we weren't playing, I used to sell orange juice downstairs on an orange juice machine. Obviously an orange juice machine.
Yeah.
But they were those sort of, they weren't plastic in those. They were almost like cardboard cups. And I used to fiddle.
I remember,
to fiddle the, so they would get soggier and soggier using the same cup. You know, so I did that. And one night in, must have been April, late April, Hank wasn't there that particular night. And Cliff and the Drifters came down. So I'm selling orange juice at the machine at the back. It sounds like a massive place, John. The Two Eyes was probably 12 feet wide and 25 feet long. That was it. But it was crammed. There was a little stage at one end. Anyway, all I remember is Cliff came down, didn't meet him, didn't say hello. He looked like Elvis. He had the burns. He was swarthy, you know, he was born in India, so he had the great hair. And I went home to Hank and I said, there was a guy tonight, he was great, you know. And never thought anything of it. Just another guy who sang like Elvis and was really good. Forgot about it. During that, from April till September, late September of 1958, we lived in the Two Eyes. We met people in the Two Eyes. We would be playing. And like I said, people would want to get up and sing with you or play with you. Kind of. And one night, a guy called Jet Harris got up. He was a star already down the Two Eyes. He looked fantastic. Looked like James Dean.
Yes.
Blonde hair. Was a great bass player. He sat in, as we call it. He would sit in and just play a couple of numbers. And then met Brian Bennett down there. Fantastic drummer. And then one night, there's a little kid. I mean, when I say kid, Hank and I were 16. So there was a kid younger than we were standing in front of us watching and had a little cap on. And he said, can I get up and play? I play drums. I said, yeah, yeah. And it was Tony Meehan. So without knowing, over that period of 5 months or whatever it was, we met Licorice Locking was down there, Brian Bennett, Jet Harris, Tony Meehan, Hank and myself, which all later became incarnations of The Shadows.
Amazing, isn't it? Yeah,
and without realising, without knowing. So it was a fantastic breeding ground, I guess, for meeting people, for playing with other people.
Because you backed Tony Sheridan, Vince Eager, didn't you, for a while?
Yeah, well, everybody backed everybody else, John. It was one of those. We didn't have sort of, we weren't hired to back certain people. People just used to, almost like a jazz club, you ever get up, can we play just to have a little play.
You were in the Five Chesternuts for a while.
Yeah, now, yeah. I'm going to whiz through that very quickly. What I'm trying to get at here is we came on April the 6th of, I'm very good at dates, by the way. I can't remember what I had yesterday for lunch. But if you ask me about the 50s.
Yeah.
April the 6th, we came down and by not knowing anyone in London, so we're staying in Mrs. Bowman's house in the attic in Finsbury Park. We somehow met, he must have come to the Two Eyes. Charlie Chester's son was a guy called Peter Chester. He was a drummer and a little would-be songwriter. And Hank and I didn't have any money and we didn't know who he was really at the time. He said, would you like to come back to my place and we can play there and jam there? And he said, my mum can make you something to eat. And then it was only when we got back to Hampstead Garden suburb, very posh, we realised it was Charlie Chester's house, you know, who was a huge...
He was
a huge star. Yeah. Lovely guy, yeah. Lovely guy. And his mum was lovely. And we used to play in his attic. Now, I'm talking about between April the 6th. By July, we had made a record and we were on...
6-5 Special?
6-5 Special. Yeah. We were on television, having made a record, didn't know anybody, within, what, 2 months, 3 months of hitting London with not knowing anything. I mean, incredible. But that was just for one record. The record didn't happen. And then within a couple of months after that, I think it was in the September, we were back in the Two Eyes in the afternoon, jamming, playing, talking with all our mates and stuff. Really, he didn't have anywhere else to go.
No.
You know, it was like the place. And a guy came down, and he, to be fair, he'd heard about a great guitarist in the Two Eyes. Now, there were two great guitarists in the Two Eyes. One was Tony Sheridan. You've mentioned Tony Sheridan. Tony was a great player and a great performer. He wasn't there that day. Hank was there, and Hank was the other great player. Hank could play the introduction to That'll Be the Day and all the Buddy Holly stuff and all that stuff. And if you could do that then, you were like a great player, you know. Anyway, he was really good, and John Foster came down. I'm Cliff Richard's manager, and who's Cliff Richard, you know. And Hank played him a few things. He's great. So I'm looking for a lead guitarist. I've got a tour booked starting the 5th of October, 1958. And I'd love you to do it, Hank. And then Hank said, well, I'll do it if my mate can come. So he said, well, would you like to come around and we'll meet Cliff? So he took us out of the Two Eyes. We went a couple of streets away to Dean Street, up a flight of stairs to a tailor's shop. And there was Cliff having his pink jacket fitted. So we sort of looked at him. He looked at us, you know. We were all pimples and greased back hair. You know, we were both 16. He was 17. He said, would you come back to my place and, like, an audition, I guess. He hadn't heard Hank play. So Hank and I got on the Green Line bus outside Portland Place, the BBC, went to a place called Cheshunt in Hertfordshire. We'd never been. That was exciting. Outside of London, Cheshunt, didn't I? And we went to Cliff's council house. He lived there with his mum, dad, and three sisters. And Hank and I took our guitars, obviously. No amps or anything, just, you know. We went in and practiced in the front room. Really, it was an audition, I suppose, but we didn't think of it like that. And we just played and went, oh, yeah, great. And then, well, let's do Ricky Nelson's so-and-so. Let's do Elvis's so-and-so. What about Buddy Holly's this, that, and the other? What about the Everly Brothers' this, that, and the other? And Hank played it all. We played it, and Cliff said, yeah, great. He said, it's a three-week tour. I'd love you to do it. And that 3 weeks turned into 60 years.
Put that light out!
I'm trying to relax and listen to John Hannum.
Obviously, Move It is one of the greatest British rock and roll records of all time. I know you weren't on the original record, but you must have played it thousands of times, really.
Thousands of times, yeah. Trying to get that bottom E in tune is quite a feat. It was written by Ian Samwell, who was one of the original drifters that came down the Two Eyes that I saw, you know, in April of 58. Written on the bus going home from the BBC to Cheshunt. Same journey. He wrote it on the bus. And it is, in my opinion, the best. It's the best rock and roll record. It's true to itself. The lyric is true to itself. The original is one verse repeated, which, I'm digressing now, it's the same story, but Everly Brothers Walk Right Back was written by a guy called Sonny Curtis. Played it to the Everlys, and he said, I've just got this one verse. And the Everlys couldn't wait. They loved the song so much. They recorded it. They sing the same verse twice. Move It's the same. But just a great record. The fantastic guitar lick was Ernie Shear, who's a session man. Well, very well experienced, great guitar player. And it's just one of those fluke records, John. The sound on his guitar, the lead guitar, and it's Ian Samwell on the bottom going, dun, 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 you know. It's just magic. But the lyric in that first verse just says it, you know, it just really says it.
I can remember being in a record shop on the Isle of Wight, okay, in the old days when you
had the
booze.
Did they have record shops on the Isle of Wight?
Yes, yes.
Oh, goodness me, I must come there.
Only just. And we were in the shop, and this guy asked if they could put on Move It by Cliff Richard. And, of course, then you could hear what was playing in the booths, and everybody sort of, what on earth is this?
What's that? Yeah, it's a classic record. It's a classic sound. And when you're recording, you know, one day you could record it, and it wouldn't be right. Same arrangement, same. You think you're playing the same thing. Think you're playing the same sound. But that is just one of those great, great recordings.
He became such a megastar, didn't he? Fantastic. The biggest thing we had, really, in Britain, wasn't he?
Cliff.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, by far. By far. Yeah, yeah. Anybody who's had 130 hits can't be wrong.
It's interesting because I've only interviewed him once, and he was such a nice guy. And when I interviewed him, he'd had 100-something hits.
Yeah.
And one or two from that era, who I won't mention, who had 1.5 hits or something, they're always arrogant and big-headed, but... He's always been good.
Always, yeah, he's lovely.
I think we'd both like to say how thrilled and satisfied and grateful we are that he's come through unscarred, really, hasn't he?
All that stuff. Well, I don't know about unscarred, John, but it'll take a while. But he is on the mend. He is on the mend. I saw him for his birthday at the Albert Hall. As you know, he's a much older man than me. He's 78, much older than me.
Yes.
And he was looking better. I'm sure he feels better, but that was 4 years of hell, which is tragic for him, because he was the biggest star by far. Anyone who tried to pin anything on, you know. As you well know, the saddest thing about all of it is we'll never know who accused him, which can't be right. Anyway, he's on the mend.
Good. And, of course, all the big shows, hit number one hit records, Palladium seasons. And it was amazing for you guys who'd, almost by accident joined his backing group, didn't you? Almost.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Although, you know, again, Hank was a great, great player.
Mm.
I mean, he still is. But he, to be that great so young was quite unique, you know, quite unique. And as I say, there were two great players in the Two Eyes, Tony Sheridan, who did okay because he had a backing band in Germany called the Beatles.
Yes.
So, you know, he did all right.
I love it when you can't stop a guest talking. So this has been part one of the Bruce Welch story, or Bruce Welsh, if you prefer. Listen out soon for part two. You've been listening to John Hannah Meets, courtesy of Isle of Wight Radio. Don't forget to look at my website, johnhannam.com, for news of more interviews and how you might purchase my books. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now.